You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Danny Kushlick. I'm Head of External Affairs and founder of Transform Drug Policy Foundation. We're a drug policy reform NGO based in the UK and in Mexico City. So tonight we're going to be talking about counting the costs of the war on drugs with my colleagues here, Maria, from Human Rights Watch, Jorge Javier Romero from CIDE and CUPID. So I just want to tell you a little bit about Transform and then about the Count the Cost campaign, of which all our respective organisations are supporters of. So firstly, Transform, we were founded 20 years ago in order to propose an end to the war on drugs, the global prohibition, and its replacement with an effective, just and humane system of regulation and control, legalisation of drugs, in short. On the basis that we believe the war on drugs is an extensive, comprehensive global catastrophe. Our job, in short, is to put governments, not gangsters, in control of the global drug trade. I just want to say a little bit about why we set up the Count the Costs initiative. The drug policy reform movement globally is actually very small, certainly compared with other NGOs. And I always say, when I stamp my feet, all I get is a sore foot. But when Amnesty stamps its foot, the world shakes. It's the biggest NGO on earth. Aside, apparently, from the Parent Teacher Association, I was told today. So the reason behind the Count the Cost campaign was to offer a way in for non-drug policy organisations to enter a debate that was perceived and still is perceived by some of the bigger NGOs as a toxic area. Many NGOs are risk averse, and drugs, particularly for organisations that have memberships that come from conservative countries or have conservative constituencies, whose funding may be dependent on government funding, statutory funding, the idea of moving into the drugs debate can be really difficult. So the idea of the Count the Cost campaign was rather than Transform had come to its position very early on that the war on drugs needed to be replaced with control and regulation. But for many other organisations, that's too big a jump to make for all kinds of reasons. So the Count the Cost campaign was set up, identifying eight different policy areas. And I'm going to try and remember them. I might need to turn around and look at the projection in a moment. But health, economics, development, security, human rights, the environment, crime, and one other one. But basically identifying eight policy areas. The job of Count the Costs was to, the idea that we had was meeting somebody whose job that you didn't know. You ask them what they did, and whatever they did, you could say to them, the war on drugs is compromising the work that you do. It's going to interfere in the work that you're doing and make it more difficult for your customers, your clients, the constituencies on whose behalf you advocate. Knowing that the research that we've done in order to put this project together, we knew that the war on drugs was compromising so many different policy areas, that it actually, in a sense, it's not a drugs issue. It just happens that the prohibition was of drugs, but because it touched on so many areas of race, of poverty, of development, security, so many different areas, that we could convince people that firstly, that particularly in some areas. I mean, imagine being a development organization trying to do reconstruction in southern Afghanistan, where the poppy is a dominant part of that society and that culture, that economy. It's almost impossible. And in places where the environment was being damaged, is being damaged by crop spraying or by the chemicals that are used in illegal cocaine production. In terms of trying to do inner city work with deprived, marginalised, poor communities where people are just being repeatedly busted again and again and again, and disproportionately from the rich. So you can see the idea of this was to enable people to come into this debate without needing to take a policy position. So the idea was that you could count the costs and explore alternatives to the prohibition without needing to position their organisation as supportive of, for instance, decriminalisation or legalisation and regulation. Now, it's premised, a big part of the campaign was kicked into gear by virtue, and it was a real virtue, of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime's admission in 2008 that the drug control system, as they called it, prohibition, as we call it, was producing five major unintended consequences. The creation of a vast criminal market, the displacement of resources from health to enforcement, the balloon effect whereby if you squeeze in one area of production or transit, all you do is you move it somewhere else. Substance displacement by which means that if you have a successful enforcement that reduces the availability of one drug, that all that happens is another one takes its place, and often one that's more harmful than the one that you were after in the first place. And lastly, the stigmatization of users. And on the basis of that, we could turn around and say, look, this isn't just our research that is saying this. This is the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, the UN agency that is in charge of the drug conventions. That ostensibly are there to protect the health and welfare of mankind, as it's described in the 1961 Convention. And we can show them very easily from their own evidence, their own admission from 2008 to the World Drug Report, that it was actually the prohibition that was causing a lot of these problems in the first place. So, the other reason why we started to work in this way was the knowledge that the UN was planning a review, a UN General Assembly special session in 2016, which was there to review the efficacy, the effectiveness of the conventions that prohibited production, supply, and use. And that this was a way of gathering evidence that nation states could then take to this drug summit to show that it wasn't working, but with an open agenda, saying now let's put all policy options on the table. As most people here will be well aware, alternatives to prohibition are now being put in place and have been for a long time. Portugal has decriminalised possession of drugs very famously for the last 10 years and has shown very, very good results in terms of improving people's health, taking the criminal justice system out of it. And now the US has legalized and regulated cannabis in four states and in the District of Columbia. It's now decriminalized and likely to move to a system of legalization and regulation. We're now in a position where evidence does have a place. It's been an evidence-free zone for a long time, but the Count the Costs initiative enables organizations to come into this debate in a very hard, science, evidence-based way, in such a way that they can explore the alternatives. And this, we're hoping, will feed into the process over the next few years where civil society can join with progressive governments in moving the debate forward. My colleagues here are going to talk to, in some more detail about the way that those costs actually build up, both in human rights and in the horrors that have happened in Mexico. But that's just to provide the context, really, for the Count the Cost initiative. And anyone who wants to find out more, please come and see me afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno. I'm the co-director of the U.S. program Human Rights Watch. I started out as the Columbia researcher at our organization. For those of you who don't know Human Rights Watch, we are an international human rights organization. We work in over 90 countries around the world, documenting human rights abuses, exposing them, and pressing for change. So I started working on Columbia a long time ago and got immersed in issues surrounding the drug war then, but now, of course, in the U.S., I see many other problems resulting from the war on drugs that are in many ways equally serious in the criminal justice system, for example. I'll just start by saying every country in the world just about plays some part in the global drug trade, whether as producer, as consumer, as a transit point. It affects everybody, and it's a trade that keeps on growing. To combat the trade, most countries have, over recent decades, launched various types of wars on drugs, which usually involve harsh crackdowns on producers, but also on consumers. The US, Russia, and other countries, with support of many UN agencies, have poured hundreds of billions of dollars into combating drugs. They've pursued, surveilled, killed, extradited, prosecuted, and imprisoned both kingpins and low-level dealers alike. They've fumigated crops, they've stopped shipments, and they've paid producers to grow alternative crops. To no avail. They've continually failed to put an end to what is a thriving and ever more profitable business. Meanwhile, this approach to drug control has done devastating damage to a wide array of human rights across the globe. And I'll just mention three baskets of harms here. First, in many countries, illicit drug profits are an enormous motivator and almost a limitless source of funding for criminal organizations and armed groups that commit atrocities, that corrupt authorities, and undermine democracy and the rule of law. Right now, drugs are estimated to be the single largest source of funding for transnational organized crime. This is true for Colombia, where I worked for so long and where I saw over and over how huge efforts were put into going after one drug kingpin and it was immediately replaced by another, or where the drug market was squeezed enough that coca moved next door back to Peru, where I grew up. It was sort of an endless cycle. But it's true for Colombia, it's also true for much of Central America, where armed groups and organized crime funded through the drug trade are committing massacres, killings, other crimes on a dramatic scale. It's also true for Afghanistan, which produces around 90% of the world's opium. The illegal opium market has dramatically distorted the country's power structure, bankrolling armed groups such as the Taliban, but also local warlords who are responsible for numerous atrocities. And by the way, this has been a significant factor, making it difficult to establish the rule of law and democratic institutions in Afghanistan. In all these countries, the profits from drugs are fueling rampant corruption. They're making efforts to prosecute those responsible for atrocities extremely difficult. A second basket of problems has to do with enforcement. Basically, national and international efforts to go after the drug trade have often involved abusive or discriminatory enforcement. In Thailand's 2003 war on drugs, around 2,800 extrajudicial executions were committed in just 3 months, for example. In Mexico, security forces deployed in the country's war on drugs have repeatedly been implicated in torture and extrajudicial killings, as we've documented. In parts of Canada, Bangladesh, the Ukraine, police have violently mistreated people who use drugs, which of course just drives them underground, making it more difficult to get them help, to get them care when they need it. In Singapore, Malaysia, and Iran, drug offenders face the death penalty, even for very low-level offenses. And in the U.S., well, the U.S. now has the world's largest reported prison population, the largest prison population per capita in the world. That's 2.2 million people in adult prisons and jails across the country. And that's in significant part due to harsh sentencing for very low-level drug offenses, which disproportionately affect African Americans who use drugs at the same rate as whites, but are three times as likely to be arrested and 10 times as likely to be sentenced, prison terms. A third set of issues comes with just the fact of criminalizing personal drug use. The fact is that personal drug use is a private decision. When you criminalize decisions that people make about what to ingest, what to do with themselves, so long as they're not harming others, that tramples on individual rights, on their autonomy, on their right to privacy. Of course, it's legitimate for governments to want to address societal harms that may result from drug abuse. For example, if you have people driving under the influence of drugs, that is a dangerous activity. But you don't have to criminalize the use of drugs to get at those dangerous activities. You can criminalize driving under the influence. You can make that an aggravating factor. You don't have to throw people in prison simply because they use drugs. The fact is that criminalizing drug use is too easy as a one-size-fits-all solution for dealing with a lot of societal problems that are not rooted in personal drug use, but in poverty, in lack of access to opportunities, in domestic abuse, and a myriad of issues that should be addressed instead. And imprisoning people who use drugs does little to further public health. The fact is that when you put people in prison for using drugs, you don't give them access to treatment. People who are in prison are much more likely to become recidivists. And criminalization compounds existing harms by driving people who use drugs underground, again, making it less likely that they're going to seek assistance and help and care when they need it, making it less likely that they will access sterile syringes, which are necessary to prevent HIV transmission. This is actually a real danger to public health, criminalizing drug use. So the good news in all this is that in many settings we're seeing some of those sorts of reform. The leaders of Colombia, Mexico, and Guatemala have called for UN discussion of global drug policy reform, and that's now scheduled for 2016. It has the unfortunate name of the 2016 UNGUS on drugs, but it's the UN Drug Summit. Beyond that, Uruguay and some US states, as you know, have legalized the use of drugs. They were joined by Alaska and Oregon just last week. DC has decriminalized personal use and possession of marijuana. Movement in the US has all been about marijuana. And just last month, and maybe most of you don't know this, Ambassador Bill Brownfield, who's the US Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, who in the past has been quite a defender of aggressive drug policies, called for a flexible interpretation of international narcotics conventions that would allow for tolerating alternative approaches that other countries might want to take on drug use. My impression is that this is part of a broader policy within the administration, because you saw similar language a year ago in a memo that came out of the Department of Justice, when they said they wouldn't interfere with Washington and Colorado legalizing drugs. They said, in fact, maybe these alternative systems of regulation might help us fight organized crime by depriving criminals of those illicit markets and sources of funding. So there's language buried in these statements that's very interesting and may signal an opening to a bigger shift. So going forward, it's obviously critical that countries individually go down the path of reform. At Human Rights Watch, we've taken a clear position on what's needed. The first step is we believe that personal drug use and possession of drugs taken on its own, not driving under the influence, but simply using drugs and possessing them for personal use, should not be criminalized. That is not something that you should face prison time for. You should not be deprived of your liberty because you choose to ingest certain substances. If you engage in harmful activity, that's a different matter, and that can be criminalized. So that's the criminalization of use and possession. When it comes to the drug trade, we are a little bit more cautious in the sense that we think there are many possible ways to deal with the drug trade. However, it's very clear that current approaches, which have this heavy emphasis on criminalization, are not working and are causing much more harm than good. They're doing devastating damage across the world. Some alternative needs to come up. It's interesting that many countries and states are starting to explore alternatives, and we're supportive of the debates that are starting to happen around these issues. And of course, it's important that the international legal frameworks be reviewed, be interpreted, be revised as necessary to allow for those alternative approaches. So I'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Okay. Good evening. I'm Jorge Javier Romero. I'm a professor from the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico, and I'm also a member of the Collective for an Integral Drug Policy. It's an NGO, a Mexican NGO, that is working for a drug policy change in Mexico. And this evening, I'm going to speak about the costs of the war against drugs for security and development in Mexico. The news has now gone around the world. On September 26, in Iguala, a town in the Mexican state of Guerrero, 43 students from the teacher training college at Ayotzinapa disappeared, and another three were found dead shortly afterwards, one of them skinned alive. Now we know that all of them, all of the 43 students, were killed and they were burned. And after that, their remains were thrown into a river. The event has deeply offended the Mexican society. In various cities around the country, university students, teachers, citizens of all kinds have demonstrated their anger on the streets. The opinion is that the crime was an act of state terrorism attributable to the authorities, since the evidence points to the municipal police of Iguala as participants in the abduction of the students, and to the mayor of the town and his wife, whose links with the criminal organization controlling the production and trafficking of opium paste in the region have been made public. This atrocious case is only the latest, though especially horrifying, of many that have occurred during the last decade, since the moment when the Mexican government stepped up its war against drug cartels during the presidency of Felipe Calderón. Different zones of the country have been witnesses to massacres, whether resulting from confrontation between traffickers and agents of the state, police and armed forces, or between rival groups of criminals for the control of routes and markets. Some days before of the events at Ayotzinapa, seven soldiers were arranged for the extrajudicial execution in June of 22 alleged traffickers at Tlatlaya, a village not far from Iguala in the neighboring state of Mexico. The war on drugs has taken a massive toll on human life. According to the National Institute of Statistics and Geography, the number of violent deaths in the country during the period 2006-2012 stood at 95,000. Of which some 60,000 were estimated to be associated with the war against drugs. According to a BBC report, deaths attributable to the war, to this war, amounted to 50,000. At the end of November of 2012, 2 days before the new president took office, the American press published a list from the Attorney General's office in which a total of 25,000 people were reported missing during the years 2006 to 2012.
Almost at the same moment as he launched the crackdown, President Calderon reached out to the US for support. The result was the Mérida Initiative, agreed on March of 2007, which represents the first formal drug cooperation agreement between the two countries since the binational drug control strategy of 1998. Mérida massively increased US funding to Mexico from $40 million per year in the mid-2000s to $1.5 billion in Mérida's first three-year phase, mostly targeted at providing the Mexican security forces with equipment and training to counter drug trafficking organizations. The first stage, which concluded in 2010, was criticized for not addressing issues of capacity building and institutional reform. In response, Beyond Mérida, the second stage, included resources to enhance capacity in the areas of rule of law and strengthening communities. The results, however, have been downright poor. Guerrero, in which Iguala is situated, is one of the poorest and unequal states in the entire country. The economic infrastructure is sparse, and its only pole of development is the touristic port of Acapulco. Traditionally, power has been exercised at the local level by caciques who exploit the formal structure of government for their own benefit. Institutional weakness and the lack of proper roads is the ideal scenario for traffickers who have grown rich thanks to the artificial scarcity values generated by drug prohibition. According to official data from the Mexican government, as well as from the US authorities, Guerrero is now the principal region of opium poppy production in Mexico. The control of this production is in the hands of relatively small groups at war amongst themselves, products of the fragmentation of a larger cartel. There is, however, evidence that left-wing guerrilla groups like the Ejército Revolucionario del Pueblo Insurgente, that arose in response to the marginalization and poverty of the region, are also involved in the production and transport of opium paste as a way to finance their weaponry and other costs. Using the resources obtained from the clandestine market, groups of traffickers have taken advantage of the institutional debility of the municipal governments. Their corruption and their traditional forms of domination of the rural caciques in order to control local police and politicians and to use them to their own purposes. The poverty and marginalization of the peasants, who have no access to credit, have to pay high prices for seeds, fertilizers, and transport for their products, and lack the technology necessary for crops with high market value, represent an opportunity for traffickers who use them for the production of opium poppy or cannabis in exchange for payments that, although low, are higher than what they would receive from their traditional crops. If it weren't for prohibition, however, those illegal crops would no longer be profitable. What has happened in Iguala is horrifying and shows the extremes that criminal groups can go in order to maintain their clandestine markets. But what took place in Tlatlaya in June is, in one sense at least, even more appalling, since it showed, beyond all measures of doubt, that the absence of legal and moral limits is not exclusive to criminals, as Maria says. State security forces have committed atrocities of the same magnitude under the pretext of the war against drugs. In that insignificant village located at the limits of the three states of Michoacán, Guerrero, and Mexico, members of the army executed 22 individuals who, according to eyewitnesses' reports, had already surrendered. The terrible thing is that this is not an isolated event. Various studies have shown that extrajudicial executions have been a recurrent practice of both army and navy, involved in war that respects neither human rights nor the existing legal order. A couple of years ago, Catalina Pérez Correa, Carlos Silva Forne, and Rodrigo Gutiérrez Rivas published a research about the use of lethal force by federal state agents in operations against organized crime. These professors warned of a considerable disproportion of casualties in the clashes. In clashes where federal police officers were the only participating agency, 1.4 criminal suspects died for every federal police officer killed. The rate is significantly higher if we look at clashes involving only the Army, 13.8, or Navy, 34.5. The authors of that report also warned that there is an unjustifiable gap between the number of combatants injured and killed during the clashes. While the police and military face more injuries than deaths, it's more likely the suspects will end up dead instead of injured. That's the case fatality rate, which is a strong indication of abuse. Let's look at the numbers. When federal police confronted criminals alone, 2.6 suspects died per every person wounded. When the Army was involved, deaths increased to 9, and when the Navy participated, the number rose to 17 per everyone wounded. The data shows an alarming pattern. The Mexican military forces kill criminals at an alarming rate. They do not take them to courts. It is pertinent to note that in Mexico, all executions are extrajudicial because there is not a death penalty. Meanwhile, neither the availability of outlawed drugs nor the demand for them, not the damage to the health of consumers or of illegal substances, have disappeared. Nor has there even been a reduction on either side of the US border. The central aim of the war against drugs, which was stepped up in Mexico with the arrival in the presidency of Felipe Calderón in 2006, has been to avoid the transit of illicit drugs to the United States. The results have, however, been poor, for according to the information from the DEA, while trafficking of cocaine from Mexico has been reduced, nowadays the greater part of the heroin impounded in the US is of Mexican origin. At the same time, in Mexico, the cartels have not disappeared but have rather multiplied as a result of fragmentation, while their levels of violence have increased. The case of Tlatlaya and Ayotzinapa are only the most visible point of an iceberg with a deep spreading base that is quickly deteriorating the already debilitated institutions of local government in widely extended regions of Mexico. The violence unleashed is driving away the investments that might otherwise bring development to marginalized zones. The cartels, rendered apparently invisible by the resources of the clandestine drug markets, have now diversified their activities and have become organizations that operate protection rackets in mafia style, kidnap and impose their rules on legal producers and traders. Prohibition and the war on drugs that have involved not only the police but the Army and the Navy have weakened municipal and state governments and have led to the militarization of the country, with frequent violations of human rights in the name of a security that has become ever more deteriorated. For Mexico, it is a question of survival to stop this war that has failed in its supposed objectives while leaving in its wake an epidemic of violent death and severe institutional destruction. If Mexico is to recover peace and normality, the resources now devoted to combating the trafficking of drugs must be re-engaged into strengthening local forces and prosecution of predatory crime. Likewise, a new policy on drugs focuses on health and with an emphasis on prevention, harm reduction, and treatment must replace the focus on police and military prosecution. The war against drugs has already caused tremendous harm. Now is the moment to call to a halt. Thank you.
Thanks so much, everybody. My name is Patrick Gallahue. I'm a communications officer with the Open Society Foundation's Global Drug Policy Program. I'm instead of Akasha Malinowska, our program director, couldn't make it here tonight. She's very sorry. She had to run off. But I'll do my best to represent her. While we're talking about costs, I just want to run through just a few of the numbers. Drug-related violence was covered, but we've also got health epidemics. In Eastern Europe and Central Asia, the number of people living with HIV has tripled since 2000. And injecting drug use has been the leading route of transmission. As the harm reduction program here can tell you, these are entirely preventable. But tough on drug laws prevent life-saving services from going into action. It keeps people away from accessing the services they need. And it continues to criminalize people, essentially driving them into more problematic behaviors. Beyond the US, which Maria mentioned, the prison crisis is growing and spreading throughout the world. In large parts of the world, namely Brazil and Thailand and Iran, drug offenders account for between 25 and 50% of the prison populations. And that is not unique. We see the same thing happening all over Latin America now. It's a tremendous waste of law enforcement resources. In 2011, someone in the United States was arrested every 42 seconds for a marijuana possession offense. New York City alone spent $75 million in 2010 to enforce these laws to arrest and jail minor drug offenders. Marijuana possession. So it's a hat tip to Vocal New York and DPA and others who got through what they got through yesterday. But these are human rights issues. They're big human rights issues. It's about privacy. It's about liberty and security of person. It's about right to life in some cases. And which is why it's so incredible to have an unprecedented number of human rights leaders essentially standing up, wading into what Danny said has traditionally been a politically toxic issue and saying, enough is enough. And I think the call is a pretty rational one, to look at the UN system and say, what we've done so far hasn't worked. We need to count these costs. We need to look at possible, additionally look at benefits of the system. What might we keep in place, as well as looking at alternatives. And we have a pretty good idea now of possible alternatives. So for example, you look at a country like Switzerland, which in the 1980s had one of the highest rates of HIV in Western Europe. And in 1985, I think it was an estimated 68% of new HIV infections were linked to injecting drug use. And the government knew it wasn't sustainable, and the people knew it wasn't sustainable, just like US voters are doing now. They introduced a series of reforms, including health services and a fairly comprehensive drug policy that was very, very health-focused, included a ton of harm reduction services like supervised injecting, heroin prescription, low-threshold methadone maintenance programs. And by 2009, the rate of injecting of HIV, new HIV infections in Switzerland went from 68% to 5% over that time. We've seen the same in Portugal, as Danny said. We've seen incredible rates of people accessing treatment, accessing services, falls in problematic drug use, and falls in street crime related to drug use. And there's a reason why all this is going to the UN, because there is a common thread among all these countries. The way we got here was over the 1900s, we had a fairly unregulated system, and slowly governments started introducing regulations, and these were intended to control the drug market, to keep vulnerable countries from being flooded with drugs from one place or another. And some of these were common sense, some of them were a bit ambitious. By 1961, what they introduced was an extraordinarily ambitious and extraordinarily prohibitionist drug control system. A number of governments chose to interpret those treaties as being even more strict than they might have, and along the way, they were cheered on by other governments. And so as mass incarceration was taking off, it's a tragedy that there was a certain drug control infrastructure within the UN that was cheering them on. As the death penalty is introduced in Iran, you know, you'll see fairly frequent visits from the UN Office on Drugs and Crime applauding the Iranian system, despite rampant executions for drug-related offenses. Now, at the same time, you'll see the human rights infrastructure criticizing them. So we do see a genuine split within the UN system. The General Assembly Special Session on Drugs is an incredible opportunity to make the system a little bit more coherent, a little bit more logical. And the problem is, I think what we see is already a split between some of the politics. We've got well-meaning countries that genuinely want to preserve an international system. And in some respects, I think there's some real altruistic motives there. We have people who look at the rest of the international system, development and human rights and security agreements, and they just don't want to tinker with it. They're so afraid of weakening the system. You've got others that have draconian politics in place that want to hold on to that as much as they can, and continue to impose and continue to embolden law enforcement agencies to be able to enforce, you know, strict laws over their people, and in some case prosecute, arrest, and harass otherwise unpopular people in their populations, and it's a disaster. Taking it to the UN system is a good faith effort to preserve the international, to do something at the international level. But I think there is a cautionary note for governments that both want to preserve the international system and hardliners that want to preserve a rigid, strict interpretation of the international drug control system. And that's that if they don't do something, governments will have no choice but to break away. As I think we're seeing in the United States, we're seeing voters leading the charge there, and other places we're seeing governments just say, you know what, this is not working, we're out. And I think, in many respects, they would be right to do so. You know, we're giving them an opportunity in 2016. So there may be a question now of what you can do as activists. And there are a number of efforts now that are being galvanized around making the most out of the 2016 drugs debate at the UN. We've got a New York NGO committee that's been formed that's going to be the main interface between civil society and the UN system, and I would encourage anyone who works with a group to encourage their NGOs to join. There is a mobilization campaign called Support Don't Punish. They organize individual actions on the Anti-Drugs Day. I'm sure they'll be doing a lot of various activities in the lead up to the UN General Assembly special session, and I think that would be a great place to keep receiving notifications about what might be taking place in your own communities. And lastly, if you're an organization, please join Count the Costs. It's an incredible initiative. Not only is it human rights groups that are standing up and saying that this is a major, you know, horrid impact on their on the issues that they work on, but there's also a Prison Governors Association from the UK, the Prison Wardens Union in the UK, that's essentially stood up and said, you know what, we've got far too many people in prison who don't belong here. So please be involved, and look forward to any questions.
Thank you. More comments. The lady I've heard it, your name from Human Rights Watch. I think it's dangerous the way you talk about the war on drugs, and then you talk about decriminalization, and you don't make the distinction that the decriminalization is only of marijuana, not of the complete set of drugs in many cases. So you're just, it's not like we decriminalize heroin in a lot of the cases that we're talking about. I mean, are you telling me that Colorado decriminalized heroin?
So we would draw a distinction between decriminalizing personal use and possession, which we believe has to happen for all drugs. The harms that have stemmed from criminalizing drug use and possession are dramatic. We believe there are alternative tools.
One thing you're talking about is you're in home, in your privacy, etc.
Right.
I mean, the possession on outside You're talking that you prefer to
You're
criminalize.
Talking about possession for personal use. However, when it comes to the drug trade, so production and distribution, we haven't called outright for decriminalizing that, but we do think that this heavy emphasis on using the criminal law is often counterproductive, and we need to look at other ways of dealing with it that focus more on more effective ways at improving health, at addressing the various harms that we do recognize sometimes result from drug abuse. So,
okay,
if I can agree, just want to add one thought to that, actually, if I can. I mean, there, you know, the idea of decriminalizing heroin is, believe it or not, not as extreme as you may think. There are 20 some odd countries that have I'm not speaking now for the Count the Costs coalition, because I think the Count the Costs coalition is about presenting the evidence, debating the costs, debating the benefits, and debating the alternatives. But what I can say from the drug policy perspective is that there are 20 some odd countries in the world that have decriminalized personal possession of heroin. And what that means is if the police come across them, in some cases that is 2 grams, 3 grams, in some cases, in the case of Ukraine, for example, it's so small that it's unenforceable, because if you have any residue on a pipe, you're still within the criminal possession threshold. Most countries in Europe, for example, have decriminalized, or I shouldn't say most, I should say many countries in Western Europe have decriminalized personal possession of heroin. Now, that doesn't mean it's not as some sort of offense. So in the case of Portugal, what they did was they gave you a reference to a dissuasion commission. Literally, a commission of social workers, of doctors, of different people who essentially say to you, you know, person who uses drugs, what do you need? What can we give you? You need services, you need treatment, you need, you know, here's where the places you can go, here's where you can get it. And it's voluntary. You know, you can't, you know, tell people to do it. They can't force people to do it. And what they found was problematic use went down. In other places, you know, it might be a ticket. In other places, it might be a fine. In other places, the police don't really follow it anyway, and they just continue locking people up. But it's just to say that if you're talking about, I mean, you're right. We should be careful about what we're talking about, because what was done in Colorado and Washington, Alaska, Oregon, and the District of Columbia is very unique to what those other governments did, which is having a very, very robust set of services that were designed and targeted to people who were in position.
Can I just throw in another potential cost of overwhelming you with too many ideas, but just to throw another couple of things into the mix. Half of the world's opium is grown for the legal opiates market. So the same poppies that blowing the breeze in Helmand, in southern Afghanistan, are grown. In the UK, we grow, I can never remember where it's 3,500 or 6,500 hectares of opium is grown in the UK for the legal opiates market. A hectare is a rugby pitch. And it's grown in Hungary, in Poland, in Tasmania, in India, for the legal opiates market. Now, none of that poppy attracts the attention of the Taliban or other paramilitary or parapolitical groups. It's cut down by combine harvesters and turned into poppy straw and then turned into various pharmaceutical products. None of which is part of an illegal supply chain. None of which accrues significant wealth to organized criminals and unregulated dealers, and is sold or prescribed or dispensed in blister packs or in ampules of known purity with quality control, and it means that people don't die when they use it. And I think that we've got to be really clear that there are two issues here. There are issues that relate to use, which are to do with keeping people alive, keeping people safe, keeping people well. And it's people's right to health. One of the things that became clear as a result of a piece of work that the United Nations did was their special rapporteur on the right to health, Hannah Grover, produced a report which he basically said that prohibition is completely the wrong thing to be doing here. If you want good health, you need to control supply, you need to keep people healthy and well. And he meant all drugs. And that's the issue on the right to health side. The issue on the production and supply side is what it is to be a government. Governments need to govern. So it's not a governance issue, it's a government issue. Governments are supposed to govern, and one of the things that they need to govern is very large commodity trades. It's about keeping capitalism contained in a way that means that the profit margins don't rise to levels of 16,000% potentially as they do in the illegal market, where there isn't an alchemy, price support mechanism that prohibition offers, where extraordinary amounts of money can be made that accrue to people who can then subvert entire states and entire regions of the world, particularly where states and governments are fragile, weak, and or potentially even non-existent. So there are two issues here. And it seems to me that anything that absolves governments of the responsibility of looking after their citizens and absolves governments of the responsibility of looking after capital and corporate organisations. These organisations are huge, some of them, and the amount of money that exists in the turnover of the illegal drugs trade is estimated at $320 billion a year, every year, and that is money that is out there, the profits that are untaxed. And money that accrues to people who really don't have the interests of most of us at their heart. And I'm not saying that most pharmaceutical companies do that either, but at least they pay their bloody taxes. And they are bound by laws that mean that the products they produce have a kite mark on it, a quality control provision, where they can't just chuck out little baggies of stuff that can have concentrations anything from 0% to 100%, but you wouldn't know. And if you were using very low dosages over a certain number of days, and then you get a high dose on the next day by virtue of your dealer tapping into a different source, people die. They just drop. And you don't get a choice about how you live your life, the quality of life, your levels of well-being, and you potentially pass on diseases to other people as well. So this is really not a good way to look after anything. So whichever way you look at it, it seems to me that it seems to our organisation that it's only when you take control, that governments are unable to take control, that you actually look after citizen well-being.
I have a question for you. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name from Human Rights Watch.
Maria.
Maria, hi. Well, my question was your position on decriminalization. Like, you said that people should be able to consume cocaine if they want to for personal use and have that. And, you know, everybody has the right to do so, but you don't really address the part on production. I mean, if for you it's legal to say, like, I can have my gram of cocaine or whatever. If that's not coming from illegal production or illegal trade, then you're just getting people consuming more, and the money is still going to strengthen the cartels. So I would like to hear your comments on that.
One, I don't think it necessarily means that people are consuming more. Decriminalization of personal use and possession in other places has not necessarily led to an increase in consumption, because it might mean that people have better access to programs that will, you know, lead them to not use drugs in various ways. But setting that aside, I agree that it's very difficult to decriminalize personal use and possession without tackling the production and distribution issue. And that's why we've said that states need to look to an alternative to the current system. What we're relatively agnostic on is what that alternative looks like. And there are lots of models out there. This is a very new area. It's not like tons of countries around the world have tried a variety of experiments with legalizing all the way or decriminalizing parts. And, you know, there are lots of theoretical models, you know, whether it should be a state monopoly or whether you should allow, you know, free markets when it comes to it, or whether, you know, how you tax them, whether you have price controls.
there are lots of options for regulating this and for, you know, allowing more or less access to drugs. And so we're not going to dictate that because we don't want to start saying, well, this is the way to go, and then it turns out it creates more harms. But we do think that you need to move away from the current heavy emphasis on criminal law enforcement. So I hope that answers the question.
Can I just throw in one very brief point on that one? Whilst from our point of view as Transform, we have gone the whole hog in terms of recognising the need for governments to take over production and supply. What we're looking at here is the benefits that accrue on a human rights basis from withdrawing the criminalisation, the prohibition, the punitive element for users. Now, as long as there are, the evidence is that significant increases don't happen when you take that element away. Whilst it does leave supply still in the hands of people who you wouldn't want to be giving your money to, that the nothing's changed on that side anyway. What you've done is withdrawn the human rights abuses that occur as a result of a punitive response to purely use. So that the benefits, you're still winning, because the costs that accrue to everybody as a result of a punitive approach to use disappear. So whilst the other bit's still there, that's there anyway. That was there whilst you were doing the punitive bit on possession and use at the same time. So by virtue of taking that away, you've withdrawn some of the pressures that then accrue there. I'm happy to talk later if you want to raise it again.
I'm Danny Maria Barney, great talk. I'm Joshua Wickerham from the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council. I'm curious, my question is about the International Narcotics Control Board, NCB, which is a quasi-judicial body under the UN charged with enforcement of international drug controls. And so they point out that the US is not in conformity with the treaties, but in the 2010 and 2012 reports, they talked about plants like ayahuasca, cat, catom, Boga, Salvia Divinorum, and others that are not in any way controlled under international treaties. My question is that a legitimate remit for the INCB? And whether that is or is not, how can we stop the INCB or other parts of the UN system from extending prohibition into new areas?
I'll hold it back.
Hold me back. The INCB, basically this is the way the INCB isn't its legitimate remit. INCB can go to the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. They can take a vote on whether to schedule something, put it under the purview of the treaty, you know, and apply various controls to it. I mean, I think I'm simplifying the process, I think, a bit, but I think it is possible for it to branch out and take over new things. What I do think, the question then is, should it? Is it a trustworthy steward? The history of the INCB is problematic. What you've got are, you know, if you just sort of, you know, go report by report. So, for example, Human Rights Watch did a series of reports on drug detention. You know, the idea of drug treatment, it's great, but a lot of governments will say, you know what, if you're using drugs, or if we think you're using drugs, or if you're hanging out in an area where people use drugs, or you look like you're using drugs, we're going to sweep you up, we're going to throw you in a center, you're not going to get a trial, you're not going to get a lawyer, you're going to have no recourse to the courts to ever get out of there. It was the things that Human Rights Watch found were so damning that 12 UN agencies got together and said, we've got to close these things down. There's no excuse for them. These places have to be shut down. Vietnam was one of their sort of poster cases. Well, that same year, INCB came out with a report that said, great job, Vietnam, you should scale your sensors up. Out of line with the entire UN system. Countries introduced incredibly strict drug laws, incredibly strict, you know, something that any other UN agency would never, ever endorse. Probably not even the UN Office on Drugs. In fact, I'm sure the UN Office on Drugs and Crime would say, I think you're going a little far here. INCB comes out and says, you know, good on you. Give it a shot. Give it the old college try. You know, we're rooting for you. consistently the INCB has been out of step with its own secretariat, with its own sort of, you know, organization, its own umbrella. For years, we were trying to get the INCB to talk about issues like the death penalty, and say, you know, would you condemn the death penalty? And Alan Clear from Harm Reduction Coalition asked point blank, look, we're dealing with, you know, mass executions. We're dealing with, you know, extrajudicial, you know, killings on a massive scale. Is there any atrocity that you would speak out on if it's committed in the name of drug control? And the then president said, no, absolutely, 100% not.
So just to throw in one other thing, I mean, in terms of what we can do to keep them out of that, in a sense, it isn't really happening. So the just to pick up on what Patrick was saying, the UNODC is out of step with the rest of the UN family by a very, very long way. It's a maverick rogue body, really, that doesn't conform to the principles upon which the UN is founded and is supposed to operate, development, security, and human rights. It doesn't conform. It just doesn't. And it's shown, so when Helen Clark from UNDP said that we needed to take a health-based approach, Ban Ki-moon has done that, and Grover, the Special Rapporteur on Health, increasingly the body is being shown to be maverick, to be rogue. And as time goes on, it will, by virtue of an increasing focus on adherence to those principles, will find itself marginalised. But you can guarantee that it will fight like hell to retain its position, and will carry on committing human rights abuses, undermining security, and undermining development whilst it exists. But it's thank God, not
going to
be around for a hell of a lot longer.
Hi, my name is Jeff O'Connor, journalist. I'm curious to know, kind of flashing forward 2 years from now, the UN General Assembly, that's going to be a 10-day period or of negotiation and discussion. Will there be concrete resolutions coming out of that? And I'm curious to know from a panel such as yours, you know, coming from the NGO community, what is it realistically that you hope to obtain there? I mean, you said it's kind of functioning in a theoretical universe, but what is the hope? That you decriminalize marijuana around the world, or are you looking for a blanket, you know, platform of transformation? Can you give us some idea of what the hopes and expectations are?
There is a spectrum of views. I'm on the cynical end. I see the way that it's set up is that less progressive moves, it seems to me, can be made within that environment than can be done outside of it. The importance of it, though, is that it offers but it's still an opportunity on the basis, and this is where I'd agree with Patrick, it remains an opportunity on the basis of the work that can be done in and around it. The world's attention is drawn to campaigns like this, to the work that Human Rights Watch does, the Cupid, the CIDE, the Transform, the DPA, the OSF, that all these organizations are gathering now, working strategically, working together towards progressive approaches that will highlight, even if it goes spectacularly badly, what we know is that it can't be retrograded. It can't get any worse. So we know it's a low bar to set, I know. But the work that will go on around that and goes on anyway has been really good. Now, just to say that one reason why this special session is happening in 2016, because we would normally have had to wait until 2019 for the 10-year review to take place. And usually that's just a rubber stamp that says it's all going brilliantly, like it was the previous 10 years and the previous 10 years and the previous 10 years. The reason it's happening in 2016 is because of work that was done through the organization of American states, primarily to do with the work that was going on in Latin America, by some lead countries there, that have forced the review to happen 3 years earlier than it would have otherwise. So even just that is a result. And it's important to recognize that, because the actual process of what goes on over that however many days it takes place is, I think, going to be pretty damn ugly. Because it's that point that the orthodoxy, those who want to protect the orthodoxy will be working their damnedest to maintain it. The US keeps talking about the integrity of the conventions. President Obama in September of this year issued a memo saying that this is Mr. Obama, the former fairly heavy, what was he, part of the Tune Gang? Yeah. heavy dope smoker, and when he had enough money, he said, you know, they get a bit of blowing. This is from his autobiography. This isn't kind of gossip. It beggars belief. But it's saying that the conventions mustn't be touched, basically. And there's somebody described it in the UK, a retreat and a new line being drawn in the sand. So there will be a defence of the treaties. There will be a defence of the orthodoxy. But the work that goes in and around it and has already taken place in order to bring it forward 3 years is already a massive result. And the comments from William Brownfield, where he's twisting to find a new place for the US State Department, where the conventions have clearly lost their integrity because the previous champions, the US, of the international prohibition, have now legalized in five states. It's all up for grabs. Things have already shifted. So regardless of what actually, the danger is that we focus too much on those 10 days or however many days it is. Yeah. We're already winning. It's already good news. So don't judge it by those 10 days, please.
I would just like to make a comment. You've spoken of the fact that the governments are responsible for their people, their health. Sorry. The comment is that governments are responsible, they are, for the system we deplore at the moment and for any action you want taken. I would suggest you not only focus on the UNGAS, which is upcoming, but just comment in part that the Crime Congress happens every 5 years that the UN sponsors, comes up next spring. Now, it's the same governments that will be there in Qatar for the Crime Congress, and they enforce the treaty. I think they are to be watched and to take part. There, it has a tradition of very substantial NGO participation. So it's a way, and a number of elements of progress, in particularly in the terms of treating prisoners and criminal justice, have evolved over the years, sparked by the NGO involvement. So I just bring that up as something to consider at the moment.
If I can very briefly just, it resonates, the importance of the Counter-Cost campaign is that it recognises the eight policy areas which we've identified. There are probably another 20 or so [S2] Yes. [S1] That are compromised by the war on drugs. And the importance of this is precisely to bring up exactly what you said, to raise these issues in the other policy areas. I was chatting to somebody yesterday about the issue of arms control, small arms control. There's a new treaty being written at the moment and signed and ratified. To take those, to be discussing arms control in the absence of a discussion of the war on drugs is madness. For Mexico, and Mexico is leading on the arms control stuff, but isn't leading quite as strongly as it could on the issue of drug policy reform. And Colombia and various other places who are suffering enormous violence, a lot of it committed using guns. The point is to bring these things together. It can be done in issues relating to the environment, in human rights, in health, that to the extent that we do it removes the issue of drugs out of the silo that it currently sits within in UNODC and brings it in to all the other policy areas. And that needs to be done at the domestic level as well. So it sits far too, almost exclusively within the USDOJ. In the UK, within the Home Office and with interior ministries in other countries, the problem is, to the extent that it sits there, you can't do anything with it. The Home Office in the UK runs prohibition. That's what it does. And to the extent that it doesn't interact, for instance, with the Department of Health, means that health is not involved in drug policy. It just isn't in the UK. And that's the same in a lot of other places. And one of the significant moves that happens in countries that begin to take on progressive drug policy is that they shift the lead brief departmentally or out of the Home Office, the DOJ, the Interior Ministry, and put it in the Department of Health. Things begin to change. It's not magic. It's done as part of a political process. But once that's done, it takes it out of the silo. And you're absolutely right that it needs to be all connected up.
Hi, Casey Holmes from the Latin America program here. That was a good segue, actually, because I had a comment for Jorge Javier. So a report just came out today out of Brazil that I think is really interesting to highlight. It's about violence levels in Brazil, but sort of the most salient fact to our purposes here is that last year in 2013, at least 6 people a day were killed by police in Brazil. Mm-hmm. These are primarily young men of color in the favelas. And over the past 5 years, Brazilian law enforcement agents have killed at least 11,197 people, and that's just what was reported. So you can imagine that it's an underrepresentation of the extrajudicial killings of people. And the reason this is salient is, of course, this is similar to Mexico, come out of the drug repression apparatus, and a lot of these killings are made in the name of, they say these were drug dealers, this guy was dealing drugs, he's a drug kingpin, but very rarely is this actually proven. So I think it speaks to how the repressive regime is really out of control and has created a frightening police state in many places. And I just sort of was interested in your comment on it, Jorge Javier, considering the relationship with Mexico's police issues.
Yeah. Well, that's right. In Mexico, we have a huge problem of weakness of the state. And if you have a criminal organizations that have a lot of money because the prohibition increased the price of commodities that could be cheap if we're not prohibited, and those income gets on the criminal organizations, then you have a terrible justice and security problem. We are not against the prohibition just because the harm of drugs is overrated. We are not talking about that drugs are good. We are talking about the terrible damage that the prohibition is doing to the states like Mexico or Colombia or Brazil. We are against the prohibition because the prohibition is a failed public policy. It's not working to protect the health of the population. It's not working to reduce the harm that the drugs cause. And instead, it's provoking a lot of death, a lot of suffering, much more suffering and death than all the drug consumption around the world. That's why we are talking about against the prohibition.
Can I throw in one? Sorry, I'm going to abuse my position unless Patrick turns my mic off and ties my hands and my head behind my back. It's really interesting, I think, that the dual position that the state finds itself in as a result of prohibition. Because on the one hand, in places like Mexico and Colombia and Afghanistan and narco states that have just completely collapsed in Africa, like Guinea-Bissau, where the narcos run everything, and Mali was actually quite a strong state
for the drug trade really mess things up there, is that the power that Jorge was saying, the power that prohibition gives to non-state actors, both in terms of real wealth and real firepower, can overwhelm states. It's interesting now, and I think that this is part of why the prohibition will end, is that this is a state-sponsored public policy that was initially developed in order to part of which was to do with social control. That was actually a way of strengthening the state. This was an opportunity, and in places it still is, in Brazil and other places, where the state, sometimes not in a particularly organized way, but can abuse its power, real power, militarily, through the criminal justice system, through extrajudicial killings, can really go for it. In Thailand, where under the auspices of the drug war, 1,500 people were killed extrajudicially by state forces. A lot of them were trade unionists, civil rights activists, but the government said they were all drug dealers. That on the one hand, it's actually used to strengthen the state. On the other hand, by virtue of the alchemy of prohibition, whereby you turn plants into products worth, in some cases, more than their weight in gold at the point of use, where it provides that level of wealth, firepower to non-state actors, it then compromises the state. So it's really interesting to see that dynamic changing, and I think that one of the reasons why prohibition will end is not because of the brilliant campaigning work that people like Human Rights Watch and Cupid and CDAY do, but it's actually to do with the unintended consequences of the enforcement of the prohibition, which ultimately will compromise even quite developed states, quite strong states, and that's why it will end. Because it reverses the power. The state actually becomes fundamentally compromised by virtue of having given enormous amounts of wealth to non-state actors.
Good evening, everyone. I just want to say that I'm actually from Boom Health, and I'm in the front lines. I'm actually on the mobile unit, and I'm actually working with the advocacy team. And first of all, I want to say that with this drug policy, we have to have people that are already incarcerated for small amounts of drugs that have been long-term, that will never see the light of day. And if we want to give hope to someone that really has an issue with, there's a distinction between drug use and drug addiction, and with people that are have addiction need to be in treatment. Now, I came from Bronx Aid Services and Citywide Harm Reduction, which merged back in 2013 in August. Now, we have to be non-judgmental. I'm sure the panel isn't promoting drug use, but this wheel that we're going on is going nowhere. It's a complete failure. People do not connect the dots when they feel their government doesn't support them when they have issues with drug addiction. And so I really need for people to understand that this is a judgment call. We really need to not be judgmental. Whatever actually works, we need to be about solutions and instead of pointing fingers. The harm reduction model to me was something that was absurd, but it's actually working. The numbers show that. So let's go with evidence-based treatment. Thank you very much.
I have a question for, I think, all of the panelists. And I've been reading through some of the material, looking over the site so far. I'd actually like to see what your recommendations are for the kinds of data and indicators that we need to gather to have a full understanding of the cost of the war on drugs in all of the 7 cost areas and beyond. So I was just hoping to hear a little bit more from each of you about what your thoughts are on what are the specific indicators we should be looking at, ideally we could be looking at, so that we can get that comprehensive kind of understanding of the full net cost of the war on drugs, because I don't think we can make strong policy recommendations unless we have that full understanding of all of the ways in which the war on drugs is benefiting some and really creating a lot of economic harm for others.
I think there's a lot of data out there already. I mean, we routinely, at least in the US, we're constantly filing FOIA requests and trying to collect data on the war on drugs inside this country. It's harder to wrap your head around issues like organized, transnational organized crime and, you know, how those flows of money work. And I don't know that governments have those numbers either. But that I would say is one of the darker areas where it would be nice to have more solid numbers. I think on the health side there is a lot more data as well. I've looked less at that.
I think that even a discussion about key performance indicators and how we assess effectiveness has taken us. So even asking the question has taken us about 4,000% of the way forward, even without actually identifying clearly what they are. Because this is such a politicized area of public policy making that it's what an MP in the UK describes as an evidence-free zone. There's no evidence. Interestingly, this is kind of an aside and isn't at the same time. One of the things that I've always felt a little bit paranoid as a drug policy activist. I thought that our area of public policy was less evidence-based than everywhere else. And on one level, that's true. Until I came across a report that David Cameron, our current Prime Minister, commissioned when he came into office in 2010. Knowing that he needed to make 25 to 30% cuts across all government departments, he commissioned some of his corporate buddies to come in and locate waste in terms of government expenditure, which I think is a very smart thing. He hasn't made many smart moves, but this was a smart thing to do. Let's locate waste and we'll start cutting there. The interesting thing was, they came back to him and said, "I'm sorry, we can't tell you where waste is taking place. The reason we can't tell you is that at no level of government, from central government through to local government, is policy developed, implemented, and reviewed in such a way that we can assess inputs against social outcomes. In no area of government, no area of government policy could they do this." And I stopped being paranoid. It made me a little bit more depressed than I was before, because it meant that we're all screwed. And that all the money that we pay in taxes is being potentially squandered. It might actually be being spent really well, but the government wouldn't know. But I think that any area where we bring in evidence and key performance indicators, but I think that part of this, again, is really useful, because what this also does, as well as identifying cost areas, also identifies benefit areas. So all you do is you reverse them and you say, okay, in each of these eight areas plus 20 others, we need to put in place key performance indicators that we assess regularly, review regularly, collect evidence for, and we show people who are paying their taxes that we're delivering what they want. But there are some quite simple ones that, I mean, in terms of costs, you can just look at the number of states that are compromised through prohibition, through non-state actors who accrue enormous amounts of wealth and firepower and then just knock the state out. And that happens with illicit substances, and it doesn't happen with legal ones. End of. Tobacco and alcohol, whilst the way that the corporates operate in some of those areas are not always overly helpful to states in which they are grown, trafficked, and used, they don't have the level of destructive capability that these do. So that you can see that the move from prohibition to regulation is a clear one. In terms of the sophisticated, nuanced stuff, all we need to do is get our heads down for a few hours and come up with some KPIs that we begin then to work to and review, and they are changed as and when they need to be on the basis of a permanent review process. But that's so way beyond what we have now
that even a discussion about it has taken us out of the over-politicized, evidence-free area that we currently have.
Thank you.
Hey, good night, everyone. I heard a lot of time the word Texas, and I think we are far from that now in the political arrangement. But what would you think about, for example, a provision without persecution of the government in the countries, in different countries? For example, in Mexico, we stop persecuting the people who sell and stop and the drugs. Maybe the violence will be less than now.
Did you say
I'm worried about the violence more than the taxes.
So you're saying keep them illegal, but just choose not to prosecute or enforce the law.
Yeah. Exactly. That was the thing in Mexico before Calderon.
Oh, the Pax Narcotica, you mean?
Sorry?
The Pax Narcotica. You mean just a deal that exists between?
Yeah, deal.
Well, it's a way to deal with the problem. It's we have to. Even if we don't change any international treatment and we have the same system of international system of drug control, we can make a lot of soft enforcement change because we can treat the drug trafficking as a market criminal offense, not as a the predator. Criminal offense. It's not the same to trade with drugs as abductions and murder and robbery. The drug trafficking is a market criminal. It's a market offense. It's not a penal offense. No, it's different. And we are the drug use is overrated as a health problem. We have to deal with it as a health problem, with health measures, with prevention, with harm reduction, with treatment, scientific-based treatment, not just abstention treatment. And that's going to be better than prosecution of trafficking, as if trafficking in the same way as we prosecute murder or robbery. It's not the same. We are overrating the drug problem. We have to manage the drug problem as a health issue, not as a criminal issue.
I mean, I think there are two issues there. One, what you are proposing in a way is similar to what is happening in New York City right now, where they decided they're not going to arrest people who will treat it as a violation for marijuana. It doesn't deal with the problem that somebody asked me about earlier, which is, well, how do you really break this enormous source of income for organized crime, which would still be there, you know, unless you create some alternative system of supply. Right. Some alternative market that is legal, presumably, or regulated, heavily regulated if you want, very difficult to get, but that somehow breaks the hold that these criminal organizations have on a source of immense wealth and power that allows them to just destroy entire countries. And so I think that's something that we need to think about, that countries need to think about, and it's not enough to just say, well, we're just not going to enforce our laws. We'll look the other way, you know. I think it's a bigger problem to tackle.
One last question.
I just want to share my concerns, in particular with regard to the addictive nature of heroin. When it comes to less addictive drugs such as marijuana, the full explanation makes perfect sense, but when it comes to heroin, I mean, the stories want to be changed a little bit. I can say that from the point of view of human rights, sometimes people violate their own human rights. Especially a heroin addict violates his very own human right to live. And that's where a state should step in and protect himself from violating his human rights. And I have never seen a heroin addict who just doesn't want to quit.
So
he wants to quit, but he cannot do that because he's an addict. So, I mean, decriminalizing the distribution or personal usage of heroin just encourages people to use it. On the other hand, we are talking about cost. And let's talk about the cost of heroin to a society. The more you use heroin, the more you lose your control over yourself, over your children, over your family. And basically, family is the main killer of a society.
So, human rights standards, just a little context on human rights law, it basically says that governments have to respect people's rights. People have the right to make choices about what they do with their bodies, and sometimes those are harmful choices, and sometimes those are choices that the majority of society doesn't approve of, that the majority of society considers immoral or bad. But international human rights law would not allow society to just break in there and tell you what to do with your body. We don't tell people anymore that homosexual sex, for example, is illegal. That's crazy. But we still seem to think that it's okay to tell people that they cannot use drugs because it's wrong somehow, or it's bad for their health. And that if they do it, we will throw them in prison. To deprive people of their liberty for choices that they made like that is deeply problematic under international human rights standards. There's also a very practical argument against criminalization in this context, and that is that it doesn't further public health, that you hurt the people who are using drugs when you put them in prison, that it's the opposite of giving them treatment. People who go to prison do not get treatment. They do not stop their addictions. They're much more likely to continue and to enter the cycle of going into prison over and over and over again. So what we're talking about is finding an alternative way to deal with the public health harms that can result from drug use, including from addiction. So it's not, I don't see this as inconsistent with trying to help people who are suffering from harmful use of drugs. On the contrary, you want to do that. You want to do that directly, not drive them underground, not stuff them in prisons where everybody can forget about them and not look at the issue.
Can I throw in one quick idea from some work done by a Canadian sociologist called Bruce Alexander in the early 70s. He conducted an experiment widely known as Rat Park. At the time that he did his work, the generally understood dynamic of addiction was understood through the behavior of rats that were kept in shoebox-sized cages, who would self-administer opiated water, sometimes to the point of death. Bruce's hypothesis was that what the rats were doing was, because they're intelligent, sociable animals, that what they were doing was exhibiting stress response. So in order to prove his, to test his hypothesis, he set up Rat Park. He took the rats out of the cages and put them in a cage the size of four of these tables put together, where they could have families, where they could play and socialize. He still gave them, so they had a choice in the shoebox-sized cage to drink water or opiated water, and a lot of the rats would really get themselves in a mess and exhibit what looked like addiction. And then he'd take them out and put them in Rat Park, and guess what happened? They stopped self-administering the opiated water, and he'd put sweetener in it and try and encourage them to get. And then what he'd do, in order to prove that this wasn't just an accident, he'd take them out of Rat Park and put them back in the cage. And guess what happened? They all started self-administering the opiates again. And then he'd take them out of the cage and put them back in Rat Park. Now, Bruce has gone on to do some other work that actually explores human beings and how human beings operate, because we can't just extrapolate from the experience of rats, because we're not rats. But I think it's a really interesting experiment to look at just as is and compare very directly with the experience of humans, particularly when we keep putting them in real cages. They're called prisons. But also when we put people in societal cages, where we deprive people of opportunities, where we don't give people the education that they want, where they don't have jobs that are fulfilling, where they can't raise families in even the conditions that these rats were in Rat Park. And people will self-administer all kinds of substances and commit all kinds of very self-harming behaviors when they're put in very stressful conditions. But if you put people in conditions where they can achieve their aspirations and fulfill themselves, they will not. And I think that the danger is that we begin to see this as an issue to do with drugs, and an issue to do with harm reduction, and an issue to do with the regulatory framework and whether doctors are doing the right things. There is a wider issue here that we can become blinkered to, particularly as drug policy activists, where we see this as a drugs issue and a drug policy reform issue. It's not. The issue of people who become dependent on substances is a societal issue, and is to do with the aspirations that we provide, particularly for the poorest and the most marginalized in our societies, who are more likely to get into a mess with one substance or another.